you want to be a preacher, you got to find a way to get the biblical text into today. And there's a way to go about it. There's a long road that you can travel, and we've made a few contributions. Let's see how that material is organized. One of the first things I got to do is see that structure. Let's look at the various aspects of context and see how they might control the meaning of my own text. Let's even do some gospel connection work across the top. But at some point, Sunday's coming, and you look at yourself and go, I got to write a sermon. At that point, you know you have to turn this corner down here, and for the first time, everything is now focused toward those to whom you would preach. Why don't you tell the guy next to you, when you get to that moment, what kinds of things are in your mind, things that you have to accomplish or do well in the construction of the sermon itself? What do you got to do well to get all this synthesis together? What are you thinking about? All right, let's hear a few of them. What are the elements that one is engaged with on this line?
Application.
Yeah, at some point I'm starting to think about, I got to actually apply what this text has learned. I've been learning. Yep. Anybody else? What's the main point? I got to actually make an argument. If I was to define an argument, I would say the argument is the one thing I'm dead set on convincing my listener of from this text this week. I got to know my argument, which is a different question than what's the big idea or what's the main point. You're now, because main point, big idea, you're still facing the text. But if you start asking yourself, what's the one thing I'm to convince my listener of from this text I'm now facing today? You get the difference there? It was Augustine who said there are two things necessary for sermons. One, the process by which you discover all that you need to learn from the text. That's these two that we've taken time with to this point. But then he says there's the process of actually presenting all that you have learned. That's this part. To put it differently, if you're the preacher up here, you've been moving at text all week long, but now you're moving here. You've got it right, or as right as you're going to get it this week. Now you're thinking, I got to get it across. And when I'm getting it across, I'm no longer saying, well, what's the main point of the text? I'm now asking, what's the thing I have to convince my listener of from this text? That's an argument. Somebody give me another thing that we got to do. An argument, application, illustrations. Let me put an A on it. We got to adorn this thing. Adornment. Got to put some earrings on it, bow tie, whatever it is. I've got to draw your attention to the beauty of this text by that which I illustrate it with. Somebody give me another thing. Audience. I'm right. If you're talking to a junior high, it's going to be a very different sermon in regard to the construction of my thing is if I'm doing it on Sunday morning, whether I'm doing it in a counseling session, all of your ministry of the word, you've got to zone in on your audience. They're the only ones that matter anymore. Who else? Anything else? Arrangement. I could do a lot on this line over here. In fact, we're getting ready to put out a little something on this, but I'm just going to grab this one element. I wish we could talk about them all. I'm just going to grab arrangement. At some point, you've got to determine how to arrange the material. My first exposure to biblical exposition came when I was 18, listening to the weekly sermons of a young minister named R. Kent Hughes. I had gotten converted the spring before. My wife now, at that time, 17, was growing up in that church, so I began to attend that church because she was there, and I ran into a 37-year-old man in the pulpit, and he was taking us through the Gospel of John, and it was electric. His sermons were penetrating. They seemed to always, or nearly always, hit the mark. And I find myself being persuaded to come back week to week. He captured in language later what he felt was going on in that season of ministry. And he said something to the effect, this is a loose quote, that there have been times when I have especially felt the pleasure of God while preaching. The room quiets, the babies are stilled, the pews don't creak, and it is as though my words fly through the air and hit their mark. I still really haven't found a better description of persuasive preaching than when that kind of thing happens. And for that reason, I'm going to give you a drawing. It's not going to be a good drawing, but you know what? I don't really care if it's a good drawing. That's the archer. Hughes, my words flew like arrows and hit their mark. This is where my argument is heading. It's heading right to my audience. But how I arrange this thing on the bow or on the string of the Holy Spirit, how the power of the Spirit, how I actually put that thing, that's either going to indicate whether this thing flies straight, is off mark, falls before it ever gets there. And a lot of our sermons can fail because they're really not on the clear shaft that just allows this thing to be penetrated forward. That's my picture. What's the principle? Every preacher must intentionally arrange his material to best make his argument. I'll even put it further. Every part of the sermon, from the first word you speak to the last, must intentionally serve the sermon's argument. Do you ever think of it that way? That your sermon, from the opening word to the closing word, is the making of an argument? And that your arrangement of that argument might actually help or hinder your ability to get done what you want? So let's think about when they started arranging material. The first guy to really come on to this, anybody know who started talking about how to arrange things like this in public speech? His name was Aristotle. He's been in the ground a long time. He came up with an incredibly brilliant, stylistically complex understanding of how things are arranged in speech. Why don't you tell the guy next to you, this is what Aristotle came up with. Go ahead. Tell him what Aristotle came up with on arrangement. Go for it. All right. Let's not give Aristotle any more time than he needs. What did he tell us? Brilliant Aristotle. What did he tell us? He said what he noticed in speech by way of arrangement, that there was always a beginning, there was always a middle, and with good speakers, there was always an end. A beginning and a middle and an end. He was actually making the comment in regard to narrative and stories, but it certainly rolled over very quickly into Greco-Roman rhetoric and that of speech making. At some point, that's as simple as your arrangement's going to be. Your sermon's going to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. Why don't you tell the guy next to you, what are the parts of a sermon, though, when we think of sermons, what are the parts of the sermon? And you have to be more specific than simply the beginning and the middle and the end. Go for it. What are the parts of a sermon? All right, what do we got? What are the parts? Variety of parts of a sermon. Somebody give me one? Introduction. Thank you. An introduction. Somebody give me another one? Thesis. A statement of the thesis, or in this sense, am I capable of answering the question, do I know the one thing I'm out to convince my listener of from the text this week? That's going to be my thesis. Yep, somebody else? evidence. We'll come back to this, but in the Greco-Roman world, evidence would be conveyed in some sense there was a statement of facts, like this is what we have before us, but there was also proofs that you would actually be proving your thesis by the use of evidentiary arguments or sub-arguments in that way. Yep, somebody else give me another one? Application, yep. Somebody else?
Illustration.
Another one?
Gospel.
The gospel. There's a man who's listening. Another one? What? A conclusion? Anything else?
Summary,
which should take place in the conclusion. That would be an aspect of conclusion. If you were to actually bring this thing into what we'd looked at a beginning and a middle and an end, the introduction would certainly be what we would call the intro. The conclusion would certainly be what he hits on as an end. And the other stuff would be certainly all various aspects of the body of the message. What am I trying to say today? How might I prove that today? How might I apply that today? All of this is the body of the message. I kind of have a thing in my mind on a sermon arc when it comes to arrangement. I don't know that it's right, but there it is. If this is my sermon, I kind of think 10%, not more, should be given to the introduction. It's not a hard rule, but it's basically an indication that I think most people's introductions are too long. I'm not telling you how long to preach. I'm telling you what percent of the time it should take you to get into what you're trying to do. 10%, I think 10% is probably good on conclusion, which means for me, the beginning gets 10%, the end gets 10%, and the middle gets the body of everything else I've got to do. That's where I'm doing my exegesis, in a sense, my exhortation. That's what I'm trying to tell you, make my case, all of that. So if you preach, all right, how many guys preach under 20-minute sermons weekly? Okay. How many guys are under 30? How many guys are under 35? How many guys are over 40? Lord have mercy on your people. No, I'm not. I'm just joking. Let's just take 40 because it looked like the preponderance was there. I'm not telling you how long to preach. That's between you. That's a relationship between you and your people. But if you are preaching 40 minutes, what would I say your introduction ought to be? 4 minutes. I can even get that down. 4 minutes there, 4 minutes there. That's 8 minutes. I've got 32 minutes every week to actually convince them of what I think is happening in the text. Now I have to start dividing my material in ways that actually serve that. If you preach. And that's actually a good exercise. Go back and listen to your last 5 sermons. And when did you actually get to the bottom? When did you actually begin? I mean, we know when you began, but when did you actually start getting to what you thought you were doing that week? And all of a sudden, if you're like, wow, that's like 18% of my sermon. You know, you might want to think about that. So what is the role of this beginning? How does one carry on this body? And how do we end? This is all dealing with arrangement. And for that, I just want to give you another little picture. Okay? Tell the guy next to you, what's that? Bad teeth. It's getting worse. Chess pieces. Man. That's brutal. This one has no intention of ever getting published. This is supposed to be, what's the little guy out front? He's the pawn. This guy is the king. and this is some other piece of your choice. Most chess games that are won, the good player has a beginning game, a middle game, and an end game. Tell the guy next to you, though, where is the game won? Where is the game of chess won or lost? Is it in the beginning, the middle, or the end? Just give it a stab. All right, show of hands. Who's going for the beginning? Who's going for the middle? Who's going for the end? Okay, in this room, it's a toss-up between the beginning and the middle. And in chess, there's really no hard and fast rule on when have I moved from the beginning to the middle game. But I will say this, that in chess, I was the sixth grade chess champion of my school. I will say that you can overcome a poor beginning. But your game is going to be won or lost in the middle because you're actually having to control the middle of the board. And if you can't control the middle of the board, you're not going to be able to close this thing out. So your beginning moves are critical, but you can overcome it in the middle game. But generally, some guys are so good, they actually know when they've lost this thing well before they've lost it. So all of these become important to actually successfully navigating the game of chess. So too with your sermon. Your beginning moves actually set up, they begin to unveil what your strategy is going to be to win the game. But when you are in the middle game, you're starting to attack what's going on. You're starting to protect what's going on. You're actually now really in play. You're on offense and defense. Let me put it differently, sermon making. You're confirming things by the arguments you're making, or you're refuting things in order to make sure your argument can stand. That's what's happening when you're actually writing your sermon. But there's still that final step. A lot of times in the middle game, we kind of know who's going to probably win this thing. But the end game is when most of the pieces are off the board and either the victor delivers the final blow or they whittle their way down to a stalemate. Very rarely does the game turn at the end, which is why the conclusion is summarizing something, not making a case for something. So let's think about this in regard to outlines. Let's think about the introduction then. If the early game is your introduction, what do you think you're trying to accomplish in order to be able to navigate this thing successfully in the middle? So what do you think you should accomplish in your introduction every week? Part of your arrangement. Talk to the guy next to you. All right. Here we go. Give me some of the elements of a successful introduction. Just call them out. Yep. You must create interest. They're not going to listen to you if you don't.
Scope.
What do you mean by it?
What is the thing we're going to study?
So you're not only gaining the interest in it, but you're actually stating kind of where we're going to be today. In some sense, you're introducing the theme or the idea. So the scope is let's put idea. What's the idea that this is going to be in? You got to state that somehow. What else?
Context.
What do you mean by context?
Literary context. How does it relate to what we've
been preaching through? Okay, so you're going to put this in perspective. Yep. Anything else?
Raise the need.
That's a great thing. Yep. Why would I want to listen to this? If they don't know why, then this is probably connected to interest in a way. A way of getting interest is the raising of need. Yep. Anything else?
Tone.
Yeah, tone is good. And let me put it this way. You have to win the audience to you. So you have to, in some sense, establish credibility. This is why when you are invited to speak someplace, you usually say some nice things about the place you are, because you're trying to win a hearing. But if you don't, you're in trouble. And I've made some terrible mistakes in this along the way. I was in Canada. a room about this size, and I was such a stupid American. First time I get up to speak, I said, well, it's just wonderful to be in Canada. I'm excited. In fact, I was really eager to learn how they came up with the name Canada. Three guys were sitting around, and one guy said C-A, and the other guy said N-A, and the third guy said D-A, and Canada. And the room looked just like you look now. I thought, what an idiot I've been. I'm an American. I live below you. You already have a younger brother complex up there. And rightly so, in just what I did. And I spent like the next 20 minutes trying to dig my way out of that hole. Why? Because I was stupid. You can actually hinder your ability to preach well in your introduction. So, introduction, don't be stupid. What I'm hearing, though, in introductions are three stories, a regurgitation of last week, why we entered into this series, something else about your dog. Sometimes I get up and the guy's first sentence, it's obvious he's winging it already. I don't know what he had written down, but for some reason when he got up there, he didn't have his first line even down. Because all of a sudden it's like he's going to just kind of meander, find his way in. Introductions, very important. You've got to be able to do this in your arrangement. What about the conclusion? What do you got to do on the conclusion? Tell the guy next to you. What do you have to accomplish as you arrange your conclusion? All right, anybody? What do you got to accomplish in your conclusion? We already had summary. It's usually not a bad idea. Summarize what you think you've done. Anything else? Call to action or response in a sense? Anything else? Stop. So many guys forget this when they write their conclusions. In fact, Dabney said, the most important thing, therefore, is that you know when to stop and that you do be sure to stop. I don't know why we don't close well. Stop. In fact, one of the most effective preachers, if you're trying to listen to people, go back and listen to Dick Lucas. You can find him at proctrust.uk.org. Go listen to some of his stuff in the 80s and 90s. He had an incredible ability to close almost sometimes with a single line. The conclusion wasn't 10%, it was a line. And often it was a way of just grabbing the jugular of the listener and kind of dragging them across the floor. It would be something like this. Well, I suppose if what we've seen here in Mark's gospel today is true, we ought to repent, lest we'll end up in hell. You know. I was just like, you want to tersely, succinctly, powerfully, with heightened oratorical sensory skill, close. You want to put your main convincing notion in the heart of your listener in ways that irreversibly stay with them. And when you do that, you're done. And you don't have to always do it the same way. You don't always have to land the plane where you took the plane off. And I opened with a story about trees, so now I'm going to close with a story about trees. Sometimes those things actually hinder your sermon because it's like, this is kind of clevery, or you know, what do you don't be give yourself to conclusions that actually are trying to, the way Cicero would have put it, conquer the will. You're out to conquer the will of your listener. And whatever it takes to state that, then stop. Well, I should stop on conclusions. I want to go to, in one sense, the body, because that's where I want to spend most of the time. We got half the time left. Close to half the time. What are you doing in the body? Let's go back to Ephesians 1, 3 to 14. We know already, don't we, that the whole umbrella of this text is that we would bless God. But we also knew that there were three components to the structure of this text. The first was verses 3 to 6, where we were blessing God because we had seen this, election and adoption in eternity past. In 7 to 9, in a sense, we began to move not only that, but to the redemption that actually comes in the very ministry of Christ that was made manifest. So that eternal past now made manifest in the ministry of Christ. And then we saw in the latter part of that text, he begins to talk about an inheritance that would take us into an eternal future. I would say that what you're trying to do is, if this is your convincing goal, the body of your message should have, in this text, three supporting arguments. You want to confirm this as the reason for this. And when you're done, you want to confirm this as a reason for this. And when that's done, you want to confirm this as a reason for this. These are three supporting confirmations, proofs, that you need to kind of win your person over with. These are not just three ideas that sit independent. They all serve my argument. Make sense? That said, I'm going to have to refute a thing or two in this sermon. If I'm going to win, I'm going to have to overcome your objection. Refutation must be present in every sermon, just as there is confirmation. Tell the guy next to you, in this passage, where are you going to have to spend some time doing refutation, overcoming your listener's hurdles, if you're going to accomplish your sermon's aim? And not only where or what's the elephant in the room, but how would you do it in a sermon? How would you, together, tackle that stumbling block that might hinder your ability to preach this successfully? Go for it. All right, let's give it a run. First of all, did anybody notice what you feel might be in a stumbling block in your text to actually be able to accomplish your listeners blessing God? What was a stumbling block? Stumbling. What are they going to trip over? They're going to trip over election and predestination before they ever get out of the door. So if your actual goal in the sermon is that they would bless God to the everlasting praise of his glorious grace, you're going to have to actually get them to fall in love with election and adoption or predestination. Wow, that's going to be tough. So what I'm trying to tell you is, in the arrangement of your message, every message is going to have some element of refutation. You can't just get in the pulpit and go, bless God, because we're elected, predestined. Well, it depends on your church, but not my church. So now, in the arrangement of my message, I have to devote time to actually winning that person over. Did anybody come up with any ideas?
I was thinking the passage is nonsensical if God has not
All right, so you're going to, the one way to try to do it then is to make a logical appeal to my listener that on the basis of the logic, I ought to be able to see it the way my preacher sees it. Okay, great. Anyone else have any more concrete ways in which you might do it?
You just can see the way people might feel that.
Concession. Concession is a big part of successful preaching. Well, I'd like to concede something today. That verse 3 or 4, whatever it is, well, that's going to be a tough pill to swallow. So concession, at least the person who knows it's a stumbling block now feels like, okay, well, he gets what I get. So concession first, followed by refutation. Anybody yet with an idea yet on refutation? We have logic as one idea. Someone had something here. Yeah, go ahead. Carol, what do you got? And so what does it say in 13?
So in 13, it says, in him you also, when you heard the word of truth, the gospel of your salvation, and believed in him.
Great. Great. So one way to actually say this is concede. This is a very difficult thing. I'm not quite sure what to do with it. And I'm not quite sure we're going to be able to answer it fully today. I am helped, and maybe you'll be helped, by whatever it does mean for us. It's not without us actually believing, 13. So maybe that's another way. Maybe for some listeners, they're like, oh, that's good to know. Yep. When I preached this, I probably spent an hour and a half of sermon preparation trying to figure out how to crack that nut. And there's a lot of ways to do it, but I do think the way you need to do it when you arrange your material, when you run into something like that, is to concede and refute. And refutation is critical to the successful oration. What I did was I said, well, we have this word election. I don't know if you were here last week, but we elected a pastor. It was a great day. In fact, we all took great happiness in being able to be those who elected a pastor. I'm an American. You're an American. Can you imagine if we lived in a country where you couldn't elect your own officers? Wow. I mean, it seems to me that election is part of individual freedom. I mean, we would die for this, would we not? The individual freedom to make our own choices and what we're doing. I guess what's going on here is what the writer's trying to tell us is that whatever we would afford for ourselves, we certainly ought to let God afford for himself. I mean, it would make sense, wouldn't it, if there is a God? I suppose we shouldn't limit God to elect and do what he wants to do if it's the very thing that we die for and make sure that we had the freedom to do. All right, now, was it successful, unsuccessful? I don't know. But I do know that I've arranged my message both with the confirmation of this section in ways that will help me get here. But I also have to do refutation to be able to make that happen. So the arrangement of your message in the body must involve confirmation, refutation, concession, arguments, illustrations, all to prove or get you across the line of what you're trying to do. The other thing you'll notice here is I actually think the sermon would have three movements within it, not because I'm a Baptist, because I'm not, but I actually would have three movements in this because that's where I saw the structure of the text. And this, guys, is where the work you do over here on structure actually begins to serve your work over here on sermon. As you see the organization over here, it should influence your outline over here. Remember where Dave started us, that expositional preaching is where the shape and emphasis of the text is, in a sense, joyfully or rightly shaping the emphasis of my text. So in a general way, when it gets to the arrangement of my material, I try to do something more like this. Anybody know what that is? Yeah. So that's not an identical thing. When you look at yourself in the mirror, you don't actually see yourself as other people see you. At least, is that true? Did I just say something true? There's a little bit of distinction between who you are and who you see yourself to be. And there has to be some recasting in regard to the structure, the elemental structure, the skeletal paleontology guy that's got the bones. But in general, I have recast, reshaped, held up into a mirror where my sermon is certainly reflecting in its arrangement the passage in regard to how it was arranged. Now, that's not always true, because not all writing material just kind of follows that linear logic of replication. Sometimes you'll get material in the Bible where there's a big contrast in play, and the point is made between contrast. And maybe at a moment like that, you're going to actually want to have to rearrange your sermon in ways that don't necessarily follow the direct linear movement of the text. You saw what he did for us yesterday, what Raymond did for us yesterday. He knew that the main clause of the message was God made us alive, and he wasted no time in getting there. He didn't do verses 1, 2, 3, 4 before he got there, because he thought the main thing that's going on in here is right here, and so I'm going to get there, and then from there I'm going to work my way back up. And then he took us and he said, I'm going to work my way back the other way. That's equally fine. Your arrangement is in some sense up to you in that way. But generally speaking, I'm of the conviction that your arrangement should in some measure be influenced by the shape of the text itself. Let's give another example. Turn to Ephesians 3. We were in this just as small groups, and I didn't have this in mind, but in my small group, I just got so intrigued by it all. It opens in 3:1 with Paul as the prisoner. It closes in what? 3:13? Is don't be what? Don't lose heart over the fact that I'm a prisoner. And our presenter rightly tried to fashion his message in ways that answered, because whatever took place in the middle was moving them from his reality to what he had hoped for them. So somehow in the middle, the body, the reader has been moved from Paul's state as a prisoner to not losing hope. In other words, Paul thinks he's done something in the middle to prove or offer proofs that you shouldn't lose hope. So now go back and ask yourself how many units of thought, how many proofs, how many confirmations did Paul use to make his point? How many? Just tell the guy next to you. How many proofs did he need to establish that they should not lose heart given his condition? And do you know what those proofs were? If you're a Baptist, it's going to be tough because they're not three. All right, anybody? Let's just start with a number. How many movements did it take Paul to get them from the fact of his imprisonment, and yet now he would think, by given what I've said, the church will glory or not lose heart in my condition? How many? Two. I'm going to go with you on that. Where would you break the verses? Where do you think the first one ends if there are two? Six? Fine on that. 2 through 6, which then would give 7 through 12. Now ask the guy next to you, what is the content in each of those proofs? It's not the same thing, but what is he saying in each one? Because these two things he thinks will overcome this hurdle. What's 2 through 6 about? Anybody?
Revelation.
Revelation. And the other word that keeps appearing? 2 through 6, at least at a content level, is about the mystery that was made known to Paul by revelation. Okay? Now, what do you think is the content of 7 to 12? Talk to the guy next to you. It's not the same thing. It's not the mystery made known to Paul by revelation. What do you think is going on in 7 to 12? Anybody? What do you got? What do you think? It's the ministry. You move from the mystery that comes by way of revelation to his ministry that makes that known by proclamation. So all of a sudden, at a content level, it's a ministry that makes known by proclamation. Now, once I get that far on my structural element, I can now start to think about how do I serve this to my people and what might they be ready to lose heart over in regard to the sufferings of God's own. But then the real trick of this message is how does this actually get them to that? And how does this get them to that? Because these ought to serve the restored heart of the church in the midst of gospel sufferings. But now I know what I have to do. My sermon now has to figure out the relationship of not losing heart because he had something made known to him by a mystery of revelation. Don't lose heart because that which I've been able to minister by proclamation is having great effect. And until you can do all that, you're not ready to do this sermon. But the main thing I want you to see is the relationship here between those parts and, again, this. So this week, the arrangement of my message is going to have two movements within that 80% time period. And I'm going to have to work. I got to work hard now to figure out confirmation. Is there anything here that's going to require refutation? But that's what expositional preaching requires. And the arrangement, back to the beginning of the principle, the arrangement of your material is in service to the argument of your sermon. In ways, generally, where the shape of the text actually is being followed in the shape of the sermon. And as you begin to do that, wow, you just become a biblical expositor, which is what we all came to try to do.